You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many Americans claim that they're bored, despite the fact that our culture is awash with all kinds of entertainment. Learning disabilities and attention deficit disorders have become commonplace among our children, and clinical depression is diagnosed more today than ever before. Stuart Brown, a medical doctor, psychiatrist, and clinical researcher, and the founder of the National Institute for Play, has written a book with the help of Christopher Vaughan called Play: How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul. It makes the case that what's missing in all of those people's lives may be as simple as improvised, purposeless fun. The book is published by Avery. I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Stuart Brown to this program. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
How do you distinguish play from other kinds of entertainment and activity? Is it the same thing as having fun?
Well, having fun is certainly a central part of play, but I think play is a separate state of being. There are things that appear like play that are often such as foosball in the office rec room, where one participant may be fully at play and another one miserable doing the same activity. So it's more a state of physiology, a state of being that characterizes us, what play really is.
Does it have to involve a sport or a game?
Not at all. It can be in the mind. It can be in the body rhythmically. There are lots. It can be playing with objects. You know, there are lots of ways.
So you're saying it could be. It's much of as much a matter of attitude than anything else.
It's attitude and something that brings pleasure and done for its own sake.
Sometimes sports and games seem to me are not playful because they have all these rules.
Absolutely true. And if the anxiety about winning or following the rules outshines the actual pleasure of being in the game, then it's not play.
Like the people who win all those poker championships, bridge tournaments, I'm not sure that they're really having play experiences.
Well, I think if you looked at some of the faces, there a few of them might be really reveling in it, but most are not.
You describe yourself as a former workaholic. What first led you to focus on the significance of play then?
Well, I was a young psychiatric professor and was given the job of trying to figure out why a mass murderer did what he did at the University of Texas Tower way back in the late 60s.
We remember that story.
Yeah, Charles Whitman was his name. And after killing his wife and mother, he ascended the tower and murdered 14 people, wounded 41. Excuse me. And it was important to try and figure out why he did what he did. And so a large commission was brought about by the governor. I headed that commission, and to make a very long story short, the suppression of play behavior repeatedly in the course of his life by a disturbed father was felt to be very, very much linked to his inability to withstand stress and to to act out violently.
Well, we see kids in school punished by denial of play. In fact, I'm sure there's a lot less play in schools today than there was when I was a kid, where recess was a part of pretty much every day's routine. So are we going to see more and more Charles Whitmans down the line?
Well, I don't know that there's a direct linkage. Charles Whitman was also abused and had an expertise in weaponry.
Well, you didn't know my third grade teacher.
But I think the outcome of constricting recess and diminishing playground play will have a long-term effect on the well-being of kids, because it's obvious that kids who engage in effective rough-and-tumble play on the playground have better social skills, better emotional controls, and a better performance academically long-haul.
Why is that? Why do they do better academically? Is it to affect their brains?
Sure does. I think the very act of rough-and-tumble play, for example, produces physical movement, and physical movement itself sort of fires up portions of the brain, and the complexity that one has to deal with the local bully, to be excluded, to be included, to understand what it's like to be punched. So when you punch somebody else, you don't punch them so hard and you gain empathy. Those are all very complex skills that build intelligence.
Well, these are boys' play.
Boys and girls.
Girls engage in punching each other?
In preschool, take a look at your local preschool with an enlightened preschool teacher, and you'll find very little difference in the 3 to 5-year-olds with rough-and-tumble play.
Now, we see kittens and puppies engaging in rough and tumble play. Is it pretty much the same thing?
It's similar. Each species has sort of its own style of play, and humans and chimpanzees and bonobos play very similarly when they're young.
Your book touches on the dark side of play. What are some of the negative consequences of play?
Well, I really don't like to call the negative consequences of play play, but if for example, one is driven to play video games and can't escape from the screen and misses meals and all social contact, then that addictive quality combined with play is certainly a dark side of play.
Well, now we have these new technologies that connect us to our work, like computers and Blackberries. Is that making it even more difficult for us to find time to play, or does it become a substitute for play?
I think watching some kids text, they seem to be kind of enjoying the conversation that they're engaging in as they text. However, I think the nuance of interpersonal eye contact and the signals we give each other when we're in direct contact with each other are better.
You talked about rough and tumble play. That works with kids. Tickling is fun for a kid. It's not fun for most adults.
No, although I had an individual recently who described her inability to have much fun, and when she and her husband engaged in voluntary tickling, they found themselves closer, so occasionally it works, but forced tickling is not fun.
My guest is Stuart Brown, whose book, Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul, is published by Avery. How do you do research on this sort of thing?
Well, it's the best research, unfortunately, has been done on animal play, where you can really objectify exactly what play does or does not do for a social mammal like a rat or a dog or a cat. We are just beginning to gain the technology for studying human play in that now an fMRI machine and others can show what's going on in active play. But play and mobility go together, and so far the technology for studying the neuroscience of human play is difficult, limited by some of the technology, not so with animals.
But are you suggesting that this is hardwired in all mammals or most mammals?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, the play is a natural drive in humans. Then why has its place in our lives diminished?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think probably because it's not as directly tied immediately to survival as something like respiration or sleep and dreams. However, in terms of its placement within the brain, the urge to play is deeply embedded in the brainstem, just as those other things that I mentioned, such as sleep and dreams and heart rate, are.
But so many of our urges are a balance between nature and nurture. Is that the case here as well?
Sure. I think the urge to play is one that has to be nourished by the environment. And when it is, it becomes progressively more complex and better for you.
So do some cultures encourage it more than others?
Certainly, yes.
And in this country, we're seeing it actually being discouraged?
Well, I think what's happened in the No Child Left Behind movement, for example, as well-meaning as that is to devalue play so that the environment does suppress the openness and freedom of things like recess and free playground play more than once was the case.
Are we seeing this in other countries as well, as they become more serious about industrialization, for example?
Well, I think there are some European countries, such as the Netherlands and the United Kingdom, where in the elementary school movements there, play is being more and more recognized as a necessity than it is in our country. I don't have enough knowledge of the rest of the world to answer that question wisely.
My guest is Stuart Brown, who with Christopher Vaughan has written a book called Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul, published by Avery. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later on in the show, our projection series looks at why we often end up rooting for the bad guy in bank robbery films. I wanted to alert you to something I'll be doing tonight. I'll be speaking with the wonderful writer Cynthia Ozick at 7 o'clock in the Music Building at Queens College. For more information, visit qc.cuny.edu/readings. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by NYC & Company, announcing the extension of NYC Restaurant Week, Winter 2009. The celebration continues through March 20th. More information at nycgo.com. The Newark Museum, celebrating their 100th anniversary with the first in a series of centennial exhibitions, Unbounded, New Art for a New Century. A complete listing of events and exhibitions is at newarkmuseum.org. Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, offering summer programs to help high school students prepare for college success. Summer at Brown 2009 pre-college programs are now online and open for registration at brown.edu/summer.
Five good reasons to become a sustaining member of WNYC.
One, it takes only a few minutes. Just visit WNYC.org.
Two, it gives WNYC a regular, dependable base of support.
Three, you decide the monthly amount that's right for you.
Four, your membership is automatically renewed. No more renewal notices in the mail.
Five, you save a tree.
Become a WNYC sustaining member today. Visit WNYC.org for details. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3.
Hey, I thought you said five reasons.
Whatever.
We're back with Dr. Stuart Brown, who is the founder of the National Institute for Play, who has written with Christopher Vaughan a book called Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, Invigorates the Soul, published by Avery. Now, the play that you're describing involves improvisation, doesn't it?
Sure. Most play is non-stereotyped. It's done for its own sake, so it doesn't have to be exactly what you've done the moment before.
So that could extend to a wide range of things, not just games and whatever. I mean, sexual activity, which is improvised.
Sure. Sexual activity, imaginative fantasies, even how you throw a ball against a wall. All of those things could be playful.
And should we vary our diet of play, or is one type of play enough?
I think if we're at play, we'll vary it just by the very nature of play. We won't want to get bored with one particular frame that we're stuck in.
If play is fundamentally preconscious and preverbal, is there a difference between the effects of verbal cerebral play and nonverbal physically active play?
Yes, I think there are some differences, although in an adult who has been physically active, when they are involved in cerebral play, parts of their brain that are associated with movement will get activated, whereas a kid who hasn't had much cerebral play needs to have the physical three-dimensional movement against gravity and time and space in order to activate those centers.
What about whether the play is solitary or social?
They both can be play. Solitary play for a person who's introverted can be joyful and filled with brightness and fun. And for an extrovert, that might be suffering, so they need others.
What about video games? They're improvised, aren't they?
Well, video games are a lot of fun for a lot of people. It's when they get overbearing that I think we have some problems with them.
Does physical play have a different effect from intellectual play?
Depends on the age. Again, I mentioned that. I think physical play is...
But I mean for an old geezer like me.
For old geezers, it's good to stay with some physical play. It enlivens the mind and the body.
You describe 8 different play personality types.
Correct.
I don't know how many of them you want to talk about, but are there really key types?
Well, in collecting these sort of archetypes of play, there is no scientific boundary that clearly differentiates one from the other. But if you go into a nursery or see kids in sort of their pure form of play, you begin to see things like the explorer or the kinesthete, the child who's physically active, the collector, the director, the actor, the performer, the director. You know, these appear to be clusterings that are natural play types.
Now, these are similar to the types that Helen Fisher has come up with recently in trying to match people to find out who you would do best with as a mate. So is this all part of the same sort of thing, the explorer, the adventurer type as opposed to the more control type?
Well, I think underlying that is if you find a potential mate with whom you cannot play, head the other direction. On the other hand, if you find one with whom you can joyously play continuously in a variety of ways, the chances are that relationship is going to stick and be more fun.
Does the type of play that people pursue depend on their personality type?
I think it does. I think the personality type of a particular personality type can be suppressed by an overbearing parent that wants a particular type of performance out of a child. And I think that conversely, opportunities can enlarge play personality to expand beyond those archetypes I've talked about.
Well, in some cases, a parent might insist that a kid learn a musical instrument. One kid will find this to be exhilarating and wind up becoming a professional musician, and the next two will say, I want to go out and play baseball, even if they're not very good at baseball. I just don't want to do the play that their parent is imposing.
Right, and I think that one of the nice things is to see a matching between the innate talent of the child, which is observed by the parent, and the choice of fun activity. If a little rhythmic kid is dancing around every time they hear music, chances are they're going to enjoy playing the guitar.
We often think of work and play as opposites. Do you see ways that we can integrate play into the workplace?
I think it's absolutely one of the most important things any person can do with their life is to integrate play into their daily work life so that there isn't this artificial separation between work and play.
So is that what happens at Google?
Google really does a good job of integrating it, you bet.
When I read about what goes on at Google, sometimes I think it's kind of silly, and it's almost like it's imposed on you. If you don't do it, then you're a wet blanket.
Well, I think that's true probably for some elements of Google, but they do allow a separate kind of play. They don't impose foosball in the recreation room for all employees and say, that's what you've got to do in order to play. They recognize that play is a state of mind and a state of body, and so that even someone who wants to sit in a chair and read a novel with some of their playtime, that's given sanction, as I understand it, by some of the Google higher-ups.
Earlier in the show, I was talking to the author of a book about the collapse of Bear Stearns. And he said when there's a story on Wall Street, some people dispute it, that when Bear Stearns was sold to J.P. Morgan, the executives and much of the staff went to the window and mooned the J.P. Morgan building across the street. Is that play?
Oh, it sounds like it to me. I think it certainly is less. It's better than jumping out of the window and giving up on your job.
On the other hand, somebody I could imagine me being in that room saying, you know, that's really not what I want to do. Mooning sounds like something that I gave up even thinking about in high school.
Well, I suspect not every Bear Stearns employee followed that lead.
So as you define it, play is any activity that's both purposeless and fun. But you also seem to be saying that we should use play to treat problems ranging from mental health issues to professional productivity to romantic relationships. So are you saying that we have to be purposefully purposeless?
No, what I'm saying in that is that in the process of doing what we are doing, if we are at play, the experience itself will serve us rather than the anxiety about what that experience is going to produce.
Well, if there's somebody who is not particularly playful by nature, can that person learn to be more playful?
I would certainly hope so, and my answer to that is you bet.
And how would you suggest somebody go about that? Because I've met a few people I wish were more playful.
We all have. I would say that there are a couple of ways of going about that. The quickest way, from my standpoint, is to go back and back in time in your mind's eye and find a moment, if you can, that was pure bliss, really joyful. Visualize it, let it come into your feeling life, and then say, how can I connect this feeling to who I am and what I'm doing now? And if you can't do that, then get a dog, join a jazz club, find some way to enliven your body rhythmically in general, and that will usually lead you into a state of play.
What advice would you give to a teacher who agrees with you and wants to take the kids out to play and then is told by the principle that wasting good time when the kids could be learning something important.
I would hope that that teacher could take a look at the National Institute for Play website and give some of the data to that principle that the principle was wrong and that contagious, playful teachers have better results.
Now, in your own work, you've worked, spent a fair amount of time with animals, haven't you?
Yes,
I
have.
Did you work with Jane Goodall?
I did.
And just by observing the chimps, who can also be rather dangerous when they're playing, if they're playing with humans, without knowing it, they can rip us apart, can't
Absolutely.
They?
Well, Jane has an alpha male called Frodo that she has to avoid at all costs because of that. But yes, Jane taught me a lot about play because two of the homicidal chimps that she wrote about were the least playful of all the chimps she observed.
So this applies to all animals.
Well, at least to chimps were under close observation by Jane, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about pit bulls. The less playful pit bull, more dangerous, likely to be dangerous?
Well, I don't know about you, but I'd rather approach a Labrador or Golden on the street than a pit bull.
Now, you've also taken play histories of people.
Correct.
And what do you learn? That is there a direct correlation that the people who have play in their lives are more likely to be achievers?
Definitely.
So Nobel laureates are all likely to be very playful?
Well, I've interviewed about 60 Nobel laureates. Two of them are what I would call grinders, who really got where they got by just persevering and sticking to it. And the others were absolutely suffused with a sense of play in what they were doing, and it was a part of their hourly and daily lives.
So how do you play?
I do a lot of different things. I enjoy what I call rogue tennis. I play with a bunch of old geezers like myself who no longer take ourselves too seriously, but where the banter across the net is more fun than the game. That's one way. And I like hiking and biking and love playing with my grandchildren.
Stuart Brown is a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, and clinical researcher, founder of the National Institute for Play, and former clinical director at Mercy Hospital and Medical Center in San Diego, as well as an associate professor at the University of California, San Diego. His book, Play, How It Shapes the Brain, Opens the Imagination, and Invigorates the Soul, written with the help of Christopher Vaughan, is published by Avery. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Leonard.